You're listening to live courtroom coverage of the trial of Lori Vallow Daybell from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
Service. The jury should be getting up to their jury room here on the side of the courtroom any minute now. When that happens, we will bring in juror number 16 for some questioning. When juror 16 comes into the courtroom and answers the questions, I'm not going to allow a recording of that. So we won't record. There will be no media recording of that. If my staff could bring in juror 16. Are all the jurors here? We've excused juror 4. The stipulation.
Walked into the house, proceeded forward, saw a patient on the floor to the right, proceeded to the patient to start an assessment and evaluation.
And then Captain Keller had already come in?
I'm pretty confident, yes, he would have been quicker getting off the truck and inside.
And so you did your assessment, and then what?
My assessment revealed that he was unresponsive, no pulse, no breathing, so I would have started CPR, started chest compressions.
Did you do that with his shirt on?
I would have lifted that out of the way so I could find the proper landmarks.
So you had said that you saw that there was... two gunshot wounds, is that correct?
Yes.
And then you saw that through the shirt? Or how did you assess that when you first entered? That's my question.
Once I'm doing CPR, I can see two bullet holes in the shirt. I can see that on the chest and on the abdomen. I can see the wounds as I'm looking at the chest and doing chest compressions.
Okay. And then he had on what color shirt?
I wouldn't have recalled other than, I guess, the video yesterday. I think it was a dark colored shirt, I think, we saw on the screen.
And so you had talked yesterday about the blood being more blood on chest, not pooled around your knees, right? Is that correct?
Correct.
And so with the dark shirt, was it hard to see the blood? I'm kind of trying to see what you saw when you entered.
I remember seeing blood on the chest. I remember not seeing blood on the abdomen.
And there were holes in the shirt, two holes in the front side?
I would, best of my call, yes.
Okay. And when did you cut off the shirt and how does that procedure work?
I continued doing CPR, chest compressions. One of my other colleagues would have cut that off. And knowing that the shirt maybe is potentially evidence, that's why I said to her, don't cut through where the holes are. So she could have cut down the side instead of on the top of the body.
And do you use like a special scissors or something for that?
Yeah, we have some trauma shears in our equipment.
Okay. And who was that? Was that Phelps? Or?
I believe that was Firefighter Kaczynski.
Okay. Kaczynski, that's one I didn't have. So who all was sitting there with you that was on scene at that time?
Firefighter Fife would have been there. Mm-hmm. Firefighter Kaczynski, the three of us, kind of like we saw in the video or like the picture yesterday, all three of us around the patient while Captain Keller was standing back a little bit like you saw in the picture.
Okay. You said that you had been a CPR instructor for 12 years. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And was that for the last 12 years or 12 years ago?
Approximate dates, 2004 to 2016, let's say.
Okay. And so have you taught people who have never done CPR before?
Have I taught those individuals? Yes.
Right. And not just like people renewing their certification, but both?
Correct.
Okay. How many people would you say that you've taught that have never done CPR before?
Never done CPR. It's probably in the hundreds over that long of doing that.
So you'd be familiar with how a first-timer would react?
Yeah, you try to forewarn them what to expect.
Okay. So these first-timers, they have to be taught the appropriate place to place their hands. Would that be fair?
That is part of the course, yes.
And so do you show them, or do you just tell them in class where to put their hands?
It's a video-based system through American Heart. There's a curriculum that we would have been following.
Okay. So if you could only tell them, like over the phone, that might be difficult for them to know the correct placement of their hands if they've never done it before.
I guess it depends on the instructions that the dispatcher gave. Ultimately, if I was telling somebody over the phone, you want to put your hands on their chest, on the lower part of the chest. It's that kind of simple, so to speak.
Okay. But without the video, if you were teaching a class and you didn't have the video, it might be difficult, right? For a bunch of first-timers?
Objection, speculation.
Overruled. You can answer.
Does it mean answer? Oh, okay. Sorry. Can you repeat the question then?
Yeah, so it might be difficult. If you didn't have the video, it might be difficult, you know, for a bunch of first-timers to know exactly what to do if you just had to tell them middle of the chest, lower chest.
I mean, you could obviously show on a person. You could show on yourself.
If you couldn't show them and you could only tell them, could it be difficult?
I suppose it's possible depending on the person.
Okay, that's fair. So do you think that your CPR class would be fairly successful if you had no visuals?
Objection, relevance, speculation.
Next question.
I got it, Your Honor. So if a person had never done it before and was just told how to do it, is it possible that they might not be acquainted with where to put their hands?
It's possible.
And it would also be possible that they might not do it properly.
That could be possible, too.
And right now, when you're teaching CPR, and I didn't say you are teaching right now, but if you're teaching a class, are they just doing percussions now? There's no breathing in the mouth. Is that correct?
It's going to depend on the level of the class. As far as the lay rescuer, people that have never done it before that just want to have the training, it's evolved and we're teaching compression only. That is a form of CPR now also, just doing chest compressions.
And how long do you teach to do that for? How long of a period before you take a rest? Or?
Well, it varies depending on if patient is an adult or a child. There are different guidelines that American Heart offers. So in those courses, they're getting to learn information for adults and children and infants also.
Correct. Right. So for an adult, how long? Like 30, 100, 150? It's been a while. So just wondering.
With an adult, they're also taught they need to call for help right away also. So that's a factor. Are they alone? Is somebody else able to call? Can they call, put the phone on speaker, start, you know, while talking to 911? And then they would just keep going until help arrives.
So there's no timing, like you take a 10-second break, you just do compressions?
Not for that type of level of CPR, there wasn't.
Okay. So it's helpful if you had someone there that you could like take turns, like I do 100 and then you do 100, because it's kind of exhausting, right?
Objection, compound question, relevance.
I'll sustain as to compound question. You can re-ask the question. Ask it in a different way. Go ahead.
So, how long did you administer the CPR before you did the flip over? How long do you think that was?
before we rolled him to look at the back? Is that what
correct? You're... Yes, that's correct.
I would estimate maybe up to a minute.
Okay. And then how were you counting compressions? Is that what you were doing during that time? Or do you not count? You just do it for a certain amount of time?
I don't recall if I was counting. I mean, I was doing the chest compressions while waiting for the rest of the team to arrive and for us to continue assessing, see if we're going to continue to work the patient and utilize more equipment.
And there were three of you there?
Four total, but three by the patient.
Okay. And then you could take turns, right? Like trade off if you needed to?
If we needed to, yes.
So that'd be a lot easier than when you're just there by yourself. Would you agree?
Yes.
Okay. And do you know how long... how long after the rolling over did you started doing compressions again? Is that correct?
Yes.
That's what I had.
Yes, I believe so.
And how long did you do that for?
I would estimate maybe upwards of another minute.
So maybe 2 minutes total?
During that sequence, yes.
And was there another sequence?
At some point, we would have stopped doing chest compressions so we could evaluate the heart rhythm. That's on the heart monitor.
With the heart monitor.
And you can't be doing compressions to evaluate that.
Okay. And then you didn't continue compressions after the heart monitor at all?
From what I recall, I resumed again in brief discussion as far as what direction we were going to go.
And what were the results of the heart monitor?
There was no electrical activity.
And how long was the heart monitor applied compared to when you started the first compressions?
I'm not sure if I understand the question. Maybe you can reword it or...
Sure. How far into your treatment, I should say, did you guys stop and do the heart monitor?
I would estimate that the monitor probably was on within 2 minutes of making patient contact.
Okay. And how long does that take?
To do what? To put it on?
Well, to put it on, get a reading, and decide what you're going to do next.
It could take, you got to turn it on, open up a compartment to get the pads out of that compartment. You've got to open that packaging to be able to apply it to the patient's chest area. If the chest is wet, which there's some blood, you need to dry that so it's going to adhere more properly, read more properly. So you could be looking at 30 seconds to a minute possibly of working through that.
Okay. And did you have to do that in this case, is remove blood to stick them on?
I would assume so, but I was doing chest compressions, so that would have been one of the other two firefighters kind of working through that.
Okay. So I understand correctly, you said when you rolled him over, did you cut the shirt in the back also to see the exit wounds? Is that...
No, we only had to cut the shirt one time. That was when he was still laying on his back. You cut it down the side, and that opens it up to where then you can remove it from the body, pull it off.
So you did pull it off completely at some point?
More than likely, I would say yes. That's typically what we would do.
Okay. But you don't remember if you did that in this case?
I know that I didn't do that because I was doing chest compressions, so I would assume one of my colleagues did that completely. That's typically what we do.
Okay. And so you're back to doing the compressions for the third time, and then you stopped that at some point. Was there another procedure after that?
No, at that point in time is when we would have called the patient.
And who announces that?
Ultimately, I remember our captain, since he's in charge of the crew. He's would be considered the lead medic. He has the most experience. He's also charting the call, kind of running it, kind of made that final decision.
And that would be Captain Keller? I'm sorry, I didn't want to interrupt you.
Yes, correct.
Okay. And then he did call it at, do you know what time?
It would have, I don't have it memorized, no. It would have been like in the charting that he was doing.
And does, who documents that?
He would have documented that.
He would have done it? In preparation for your testimony here today, did you review the 911 call at all?
Not in preparation for today. Not the actual audio, no.
No?
No, not today, not for this.
What did you review for today?
I was able to look at the incident times were dispatched by Phoenix Fire Department. I was able to look at the paper documentation. I was able to see my testimony from Idaho. I was able to see my testimony with Chandler PD when they came to the fire station a couple of weeks after this incident.
And what paper documentation did you actually take a look at?
It would have been the chart that Captain Keller documented.
And what does that chart consist of?
There would be scene times, you know, date, time, address, patient information, name, address, maybe medical history, things that we, you know, a narrative of what we discovered, what we've done, treatments that we've done, the heart rhythm from the monitor gets attached to it.
So that would all be in Captain Keller's report?
Correct.
And you did take a look at that for in preparation for today?
Yes.
And did you write a report regarding this incident?
No.
You don't have to document anything?
Just one person documents the call.
So for all of the people that were there from fire?
Correct.
Okay. So that's the total report. You just give your input to him and he puts it into the report?
Correct.
And that's the same for the other two firefighters that were along with you?
That's correct.
Okay. So they don't have their own individual reports as well?
No.
Okay. And what time were you dismissed from the scene?
We probably only remained an additional 5 to 10 minutes. The chart would have that time. I don't necessarily have it by memory.
So how long were you at the scene total? Like,
if I had to estimate without looking at it, I would say approximately 20, 25 minutes.
Okay. And then you were like the driver of the truck, right? Was that your responsibility?
Correct.
So you drove in and then did you drive out as well?
Correct.
Okay. So if you guys arrived around 8:41 or something like that, then you left around 25 minutes later. Would that be accurate?
I guess when I was giving that estimate of like the 20-25, I was even including like our dispatch time from the time we're dispatched driving to the scene. So if you're wanting to know actual on-scene time, it might be closer. Instead of the 20 to 25, it might be more of a closer to 20 solid. Like
20 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. And is that typical for a call?
It can vary depending on the calls.
Okay. So when you, what other things did you do in that 20 minutes besides administer to the patient?
So I'm including in that time while we're staged around the corner, waiting for PD to arrive, then for PD to clear the scene, for us to drive to the scene. There's the time with the patient, and then there's going to be the cleanup afterwards, removing our equipment, going outside, maybe the equipment needs to be cleaned, restocked, ready for another call. So when we drive away, we're ready to respond to another emergency and then drive away.
Okay. So when you were coming, when you were done with the patient and you were going through that procedure of cleaning, were you in the house or did you exit the house?
We'll remove all of our stuff and we'll go outside, typically to the front bumper of the fire truck.
And then what do you do?
We have cleaning chemicals on the truck that we could get out to, you know, clean our equipment up to reuse it. We've got cabinet with restock to be able to restock anything that might need to be. So we'll take care of those things to be ready to respond to another call.
Okay. And while you were out front, did you see Alex on the curb?
I did see somebody on the curb. Or I don't remember if he was on the curb or standing, but I remember seeing somebody with an officer or officers. I don't recall how many people might have been together.
Okay. And did you converse with those officers at all during that time?
I don't believe so. I don't really remember conversing with any officers on scene. That would have been more Captain Keller charting, documenting, kind of getting information from them. He would be able to answer that question.
Okay. So did you, was anybody in firefighting on your team, the four of you that were there, was anyone asked to take a look at Alex?
We were not.
Okay. Let's see. Have you spoken to the media about this case?
Can I have an object? Relevance?
What's the relevance?
What is the relevance, Your Honor?
Yeah.
Just to know how many times he's given testimony?
Your Honor, I'm right. Maybe we can sidebar.
Yeah, I don't want to. All right, let's go on a sidebar.
Okay, just a few more questions. Mr. Cowden, is it possible that if there was a wound to the chest, that doing compressions on that could cause other damage?
I suppose it's possible, but ultimately it doesn't matter. If the heart isn't beating, it's what you got to do. It's the appropriate treatment.
So would a calm person who doesn't know how to do CPR maybe hesitate about pushing on a bullet wound?
Objection, speculation.
Sustained.
But you wouldn't.
Can you repeat the question?
You wouldn't hesitate to push on the bullet wound if the heart was stopped?
No, I wouldn't.
And you would have to assess if the heart was stopped in order to do that?
Yes, you would check a pulse like we did. We would use our equipment like we did.
Okay. So the two wounds that you saw when you first got there, one was in the chest and one was where?
In the abdomen.
On the right side or the left side?
I would be speculating as to how the specific spot or area without actually maybe seeing documentation.
Okay. Can you tell me about the, I think there's a word for it, but I'm sorry, I can't remember what it was. The crunch.
When doing the chest compressions?
Correct.
I don't know if there was necessarily a certain word that I used, but you feel the sternum crack. I compare it to, like I said before, cracking your knuckles.
And how much pressure would you have to apply to get the crack?
That could vary, like depending on who you're doing CPR on.
Like on an adult male?
I mean, it could still vary depending on, you know, the strength of the person doing CPR also. It could vary depending on the size of that adult male also. So I've never seen like any science that might say you got to deliver this much pounds of force or anything.
Right, so, like 400 pounds of pressure or something.
Yeah, I don't know. Right.
Okay.
You're just going to push there hard.
Hold on.
Sorry.
Can't have you talk over one another. So he's finished his answer. Go ahead and answer your next question.
So there's no determined amount of pressure, correct?
Just hard and fast. When it comes to people doing CPR, for us, we're working as a team. You know, we have equipment that can tell us if we're pushing hard enough. For a person without that equipment, just hard and fast.
Okay, that's fair. And then they don't always get the crack, right? It's not always going to happen.
If they're doing it forcefully enough, they would.
So if they didn't do it forcefully enough, it wouldn't.
That is possible, yes.
But then when you come in, the professionals, and you apply the correct amount of force, then you would hear the crack.
Yes.
And is that possible that that happened in this case?
It is possible.
Okay. No more questions.
All right. Redirect.
Does 911 have to regularly instruct people on how to perform CPR?
I don't know if I can answer that since I don't, you know, do that, since I'm not 911.
Have you regularly heard while listening to a radio 911 instructing people on how to do CPR?
We have had PTI information when we're responding to a call that will tell us that they are either performing CPR or being instructed to.
So you've seen in the past that 911 is prepared to handle individuals who may not know how to perform CPR.
Yes.
And that's to help try to keep the patient's blood moving while you're en route.
Correct.
You were asked a lot about trading off and other people doing compressions. At this scene with this patient, Charles Vallow, did you ever trade off and have someone else do the CPR compressions?
No.
You were the only one doing the CPR compressions?
Yes.
Were you doing CPR while another paramedic or EMT was getting the heart monitor ready?
Yes.
So this timeline of however long it took them is in conjunction with you still performing CPR?
Yes.
You talked about Charles's shirt being cut. If photographs from the scene show his shirt still around his neck, would that indicate that it wasn't removed from him?
After the cutting?
Yeah. So if police, let me ask you this. When you guys are done and he's called deceased, do you put his clothing back on or modify him in any way?
No, we would just take our equipment that's necessary to take.
So if his shirt was still around his neck, then that's how it would have been left?
Correct.
Okay. You were asked about whether or not you should perform CPR on a person who has a gunshot wound. Is there any reason why a person with a gunshot wound would not need to have blood circulating through their body to bring oxygen versus some other type of injury?
No.
Is the whole point of CPR to make sure that blood is circulating to get oxygen to their brain?
Yes.
So that they don't go brain dead?
Yes.
And you said that ultimately it wouldn't matter if you cause more injuries because if they're brain dead, who cares, right?
Correct.
In your assessment, did you feel that no one had performed CPR on Charles Vallow before you arrived?
I had felt that, and I do know in my testimony to Chandler PD, I had stated that, or it's probably in my testimony that it was not efficient or something to those lines, but I felt like no, it had not.
Okay, you felt like no, it had not been done.
Correct.
Thank you. I have no other questions.
All right, I see at least one juror question. We'll go on a sidebar. Please, if you're a juror and you have any additional questions, pass down your question to the basket. All right, so you're going to come on up here. I'm going to stand right here and be sworn in.
Can you spell your name for the record?
K-E-N-T-K-E-L-L-E-R.
Thank you. Please raise your right hand. You do solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
I do.
All right, you're going to come up this ramp over here and have a seat to my left. Go ahead.
Thank you. Sir, would you please introduce yourself to the jury?
My name is Kent Keller. I'm a recently retired captain with Chandler Fire Department.
When did you retire?
April of 2022.
And how long did you work with the Chandler Fire Department?
32 years.
While you were there in, let's talk about 2019, what were your duties? What was your rank?
My rank was captain. I was an engine captain, so a company officer. I was in charge of a four-person crew. We basically respond for calls to service and the different functions of a...
Did those calls for service include medical calls?
Yes, ma'am.
Did you have any training in the area of medical treatment yourself?
Yes, I am a paramedic. I went to paramedic school in 1991.
And can you tell us, is there or was there ongoing type of continuing training to be a paramedic?
Yes. Yes, ma'am. There is continuing education throughout the year. You have to have a certain number of hours in each subject, and as well as updates as far as pharmacology or different treatment modalities. So, yes, there is constant change.
And the difference between a paramedic and an EMT?
Well, an EMT is EMTB, EMT basic. A paramedic is an EMT paramedic. So the biggest difference would be invasive treatments. So you're trained with more ability to provide care, cardiology and pharmacology.
When fire gets a call of a person who is shot, what is sort of the normal response? What does fire do when they are coming to a scene and they know a person has been shot?
Well, what they normally would do is you get the dispatch, you look on a map, you route yourself in, and then you would determine a safe place to stage while the scene is secured by PD.
Okay. And then how do you learn that the scene is secure?
In Chandler, anyway, we have interagency communication. So you're on the radio both with Phoenix Dispatch and Chandler PD, direct car-to-car or to Chandler PD Dispatch.
So you're actually then told by Chandler Police that it's secure and you can come in?
Yes, ma'am. They will give you a scene safe or code 4 and cop talk.
When you arrive on scene as the captain, what is your role when you get there?
My role is scene safety, primary scene safety. That's rule number one in everything that we do. And in other words, as I arrive on scene, I'm going to make sure with PD that there are no more threats for our crew and get direction to where we need to do treatment.
When you have this team of four, how do you determine who does what?
Well, I mean, that's an individual crew training, and some crews might have specific jobs. Ours is more of a fill and flow. As you come to, I guess I should say, one person is charting. One person is going to be the paramedic in charge of the call. So he's running the call. His job is bigger picture. And then that'll leave three people for hands-on treatment until a two-person rescue would arrive, an ambulance would arrive to help, if that were the case.
Does fire ever respond to a scene and then advise that a person is deceased?
Certainly.
And if fire responds, determines a person is deceased, and this is potentially a crime scene, what does fire do at that point?
Well, fire then would pick up their gear and leave without disturbing that scene as much as possible. I mean, we have gear. We spread out our gear when we get to a patient. You know, we have monitors and drug boxes and trauma treatment boxes. So as soon as it's determined that the patient is not viable, then you would pick up that gear and leave the scene. What you don't want to do is interfere with any investigation going forward.
And even when you are working on a person, are you trying to limit impacting the scene itself to the best of your ability?
Yes. Our job would be to determine if treatment is necessary and then do that treatment regardless. But yes, what I should do, what the captain or whoever that paramedic should do with that has the larger picture would be to try and minimize any disturbing of the scene.
But obviously, taking care of the patient is the primary focus, even if that causes the scene to be disturbed.
Yes, ma'am.
Were you working on July 11th of 2019 around 8:30 in the morning?
Yes.
Do you recall responding to a shooting at 5531 South Four Peaks in Chandler?
Yes.
When you responded or first went to this scene, did you guys stage like we've discussed?
Yes, ma'am.
And you advised that you're being provided information from two different sources?
Yes, our primary source is Phoenix Dispatch. But yes, you are able to monitor Chandler PD as well.
Is Phoenix Dispatch 911?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So you're getting what's coming in from 911. Are they relaying information to you?
Yes.
Are things like whether or not the patient is receiving CPR something that is very relevant to you?
Yes.
In this case, did you receive any information regarding that?
Yes. We were told that CPR instruction had been given and CPR was in progress.
Does 911, in your experience in over 30 years, are they able to provide instruction for lay people who may not know how to do 911 or not know how to do CPR compressions?
Yes, they are actually certified to do that. They train and are certified to give that that instruction over the phone.
So even though it's only verbal, they've been trained to have how to present that to a person over the phone?
Yes.
So you are advised that CPR instructions have been given and that CPR is being, or that compressions are being given?
Yes. Been a little while, but yes, I believe that I was told. I do know that instruction. I do remember specifically hearing that CPR in progress. I believe I remember. I would have to, but definitely the CPR instructions were okay. Had been given.
Does knowing that a person has been receiving CPR impact the way you view a patient when you enter a scene?
Yes.
How?
Well, because it would make the patient more viable. If adequate CPR were given prior to our arrival, then you would hope that good CPR was given and that oxygenated blood was being pushed around the body, which would mean that make the patient more viable at that point.
When you go to a scene where you believe CPR is given, such as this one, was that one of the things, I guess, that was part of your decision-making as you are assessing this patient?
Yes.
Can you talk to us about when you entered this residence? What do you recall?
When I entered the residence, I recall thinking that the house seemed empty, like it was either being moved into or moved out of. So there was no furniture or anything. We had a clear path to where the patient was. And I remember thinking that there's very little in this room other than the patient.
Okay. Did you notice at any point some items around the patient?
The only thing I remember being around the patient was a baseball bat and a ball cap.
And do you recall at this point where those items were in relation to him?
Yes, I believe the baseball bat would have been on the patient's right and the ball cap above him somewhere in the room. I think the baseball bat was against the wall on his right.
Do you recall ever seeing a bullet near the victim?
Once we started assessing, I did see a spent round on the floor.
So that's sort of a little bit into you're in
yes,
the seam.
Yes.
Wasn't something you initially recognized.
No.
While you're in there, was there any officers in the room with you or inside the house?
There was at least one officer still clearing the house, I believe, or at least going through the house. I only recall for sure one officer being interior.
Can you describe for us how the patient, how Charles was laying when you first observed him?
Yes, ma'am. He was laying supine. He was laying on his back. As we entered, his head was towards us, so geographically, I think north. So that's how he was laying supine.
Do you recall anything about his arms or hands, where they were?
I don't. To his sides, I don't recall, honestly.
Did you observe any injuries to this, to Charles, to this patient?
Yes, he had evidently a gunshot wound to his center chest. Okay. Hole in the shirt and a small amount of blood.
Did you recall or notice anything about where the blood was pooling from that shot to the chest?
At that time, I did not, because we have to expose the patient, and the so he's a big guy, so he had a small amount of blood above his sternum.
I'm showing you Exhibit 3 that's previously been admitted. Does that look like?
If it adjusts a little bit, but okay. you can attempt.
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Are you able to see that there?
Yes.
Kind of. Does this look like the patient that you were working on?
Yes.
And in this, do you see the blood pooling in Exhibit 3 there?
Yes.
Is that sort of what you were talking about?
Yes. Here in around the collarbone. So there's a divot here.
Would you describe this patient as a fit man?
He seemed to be, yes.
When you saw that pooling like that, did that stand out to you or seem at all impactful in your decision of whether or not CPR had been given prior to your arrival?
Yes.
Why is that?
Because had adequate CPR been given there, I would have expected more blood possibly on there and perhaps a pool of blood under him. I didn't see any blood under him. I mean, when we first got there.
So when you guys first arrived, let's go back to sort of describing the scene. You said that you didn't notice any blood pooling under him.
I did not.
And is that something that you guys are cognizant of, since you're going to have to get down and around him?
Yes, but we're more cognizant of it because it would indicate an exit wound. And obviously, the more blood there is, the more the heart was beating or CPR was being done.
Okay. So both the lack of spreading on him is one indication that kind of made you question if CPR had been given?
Yes, ma'am.
And the lack of pooling of blood underneath him was another sort of...
Yes.
...flag to you that maybe CPR had not been given.
And no one was doing CPR when we got there. Would have been the primary indicator to me. And I say that because if CPR were in progress by PD, if there were an officer there doing CPR, then they would have continued to do CPR until we relieved them.
If a person is shot and deceased and you start giving them compressions, can you still push blood out of those wounds?
Yes, ma'am.
Now, at some point when fire arrives and they are assessing a patient, do they, I'm going to put up Exhibit 4 here, do you need to try to remove any garments that might be around those potential gunshot wounds?
Yes, you would expose the patient.
Why is that?
Well, because you don't know for sure how many gunshots there are. You check for exit wounds. Some gunshot wounds, some entry wounds are minimal. You wouldn't see them, you know, you could go through a shirt and not see them. So you expose the patient.
Okay. I have exhibit 4 up here from body cam from a officer that's previously been admitted. Do you recognize who these people are and where this is?
Yes, ma'am.
And is this you?
It is.
So in this case, at some point, was Charles's shirt cut in any way to allow access to those gunshot wounds?
That would be the norm is, at this point, they would be cutting his shirt.
Do you recall from this scene how many gunshot wounds you observed to the front of Mr. Vallow?
I believe 2.
Okay. Now, when you guys first arrived on scene, do you check the pulse? Like, what do you do when you first get there?
Yes, you would check for pulses, carotid pulse, and obvious signs of life, breathing, so chest rise and fall, as you are walking up to a patient.
So in this case, for Charles Vallow, did you guys find a pulse?
No, ma'am.
Did you notice him breathing?
No.
Do you do any other assessments before you start compressions?
No.
So if he's not breathing and you don't see that he has a pulse, why begin CPR? Why start compressions?
Because you don't know how long he has not been breathing or not had a pulse. Okay. He could have just stopped those things moments before we got there, which would make him a viable candidate, or a viable patient, rather.
And does, again, the fact that you believe CPR had been performed prior to you arriving also play into your decision to
yes.
see if he's viable?
Yes.
As other officers are doing compressions, what are you doing there?
So I am charting. So I am, in this particular case, I was running the call. So I'm going down a checklist, gathering information, getting listening to what they're telling me, and having them, I'm directing them throughout the call.
Okay. So at some point, our compressions stopped to assess the patient in other ways?
Yes, after a heart monitor is on.
Okay. And so are compressions able to be performed while someone else is getting the heart monitor ready?
Yes. Compressions continue throughout until you stop compressions to check for pulses.
Okay. Do you ever want to check a patient who you see has gunshot wounds, such as Mr. Vallow here, to see if there's exit wounds?
Yes, ma'am, immediately. So they would have cut his shirt, taken his shirt off, rolled him, checked for exit wounds, and then rolled him back and continued compressions.
In this case, are you documenting your observations and others about what you observed when he was rolled?
Yes.
So when he's rolled, you're looking at his back?
Back. Right, from the back of the head to the back of the feet.
Okay. So he's completely rolled over so that you can see his back.
Yes.
Did you notice anything about Mr. Vallow's back that may have indicated he'd been there for significantly longer than you originally thought?
He did have lividity. So there was modeling, skin modeling, and lividity. Once the shirt comes off, then you could see modeling on the skin, and lividity had begun to form.
Can you tell us what modeling means?
Modeling is sort of a patchy-looking skin caused from hypoxia or not enough oxygen getting to the skin. I mean, you can have mottled skin for different reasons, but in this case, it would be from his heart not beating.
Okay. And then you said lividity. What does
yes,
that
ma'am.
Mean?
So lividity is the pooling of blood, and that takes longer, much longer. So the blood will begin to leave the tissues and gravity drain to the lowest part of the body.
So when the blood isn't being circulated by either CPR or the heart, mm-hmm. the blood just starts to pool there?
Yes.
And so you noticed that as well when he was rolled?
Yes.
Did you notice any exit wounds?
I did notice at least one exit wound, yes.
After you looked at his back, do you recall, I guess, when in this process you checked his heart monitor, when that was done?
I do not. This all happens simultaneously. You ask what these different people are doing. They're doing all of those things simultaneously. So your patient is exposed, CPR has begun, the evaluation, the rest of the evaluation is happening. So timeline, it's on the heart monitor, I'm sure, but a lot of it happens simultaneously. That answer the question. You asked that again. I'm sorry.
I believe so. Do you recall what the heart monitor results were?
Asystole. No electrical rhythm in the heart. Flatline.
Do you ever look at a patient's pupils?
Yes, ma'am. Always.
What's that for?
Because if it's just a brain function. If you shine light on pupils, they react. When the brain stops to function, hypoxia sets in. The pupils will dilate and remain fixed, so they won't change. They're non-reactive to light.
What did you see with Mr. Vallo?
They were fixed and non-reactive.
So we heard about the pooling of the blood on Mr. Vallo when you first arrived. As CPR was being done, did you notice any blood being pushed out of his body?
A little bit more. Again, he is on his back. Exit wound was in his back. But yes, we increased the amount of blood under the patient by doing CPR.
When you first arrived, did you notice any active bleeding?
No, ma'am.
What's the relevance of no active bleeding?
No heartbeat.
Were you advised of Scott Cowden's information about when he started CPR, hearing the crunch? Or feeling, I guess, the crunch of him performing CPR.
Was I advised of it?
Yeah, did he let you know that?
No, but that would be expected.
And is that expected if CPR hadn't been performed?
No, not adequately. Okay. Again, big guy, so that the sternum will, the cartilage holding the sternum to the ribs breaks, gives way, so, and that actually makes CPR much easier.
In this case, you came in, he wasn't breathing, he was pulseless, his pupils were dilated, the heart monitor said there was no activity, correct?
Yes.
When you looked at his back, you noticed both mottling, which meant that the blood wasn't moving through his body?
Yes, and mottling was on the front as well.
Okay.
So as that blood pools, so it leaves the tissue, you know, that's gonna hasten the mottling part of it. So
you noticed that when the shirt was then cut and
yes.
he was exposed?
Yes.
As well as when he was rolled?
Yes.
And then you also noticed on the back the lividity of the blood pooling there?
Yes.
When you, I guess, obtained all of that information, did you end life-saving measures?
Yes.
Who decides to end life-saving measures?
I do. as well as the rest of the crew. So Scott Cowden is also a paramedic, and he concurred. So then we call that in, and we cease life-saving function, or attempts, rather.
There's more live courtroom coverage coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a second from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.